Do you ever notice? The war stories people dine out on are rarely actual combat exploits, at least not when the diners include World War II vets. It's only now, 50 years after the war ended, that those stories are squirming their way out. And in a few cases, racing up the bestseller lists. James Bradley's book, Flags of Our Fathers, tells the story behind one of the most famous images of the war in the Pacific. The AP photo of a small knot of GIs struggling to raise the American flag on Iwo Jima. James Bradley's father, John Bradley, was one of the six men in that picture, and one of the three who made it home. Far from trading on his tale of glory, though, John Bradley never talked about what he'd done in the war. James Bradley told me his father's story was almost buried with him.
Well, my dad died in 1994, and I phoned my mother, and I asked her to tell me everything he ever told her about Iwo Jima, because I thought he probably confided in her. And she said, well, that won't take long. He only talked about it once on our first date for 7 or 8 disinterested minutes and never again in a 47-year marriage. Then the next day, my father's captain on Iwo Jima calls my mom and says, Mrs. Bradley, did you know your husband was one of the most decorated veterans of World War II? He was awarded the Navy Cross for saving someone's life. And my mom said, no, he kept it secret from his wife, community, and family for 50 years.
I'm curious. I guess you can understand how he might not have talked about it, but people did know that he was one of the six men who raised that flag.
Yes. If you think, I mean, how could you have, as children, we couldn't avoid it. But if you asked him about it, he was very adroit about getting off the subject. He would say, yeah, geez, if only there hadn't been a flag on that pole. Betty, what's for lunch? And then he's gone. And then you'd have to wait another 7 years to set the trap to ask him a question.
Yeah. We should, because you've done such a vivid job of describing it, we should talk a little bit about what this actually was. In fact, we should talk a little bit about Iwo Jima. These guys had a couple of them been in combat, so they knew what was coming. But could anybody have been prepared for that day when the Marines landed?
No. No one had seen the number one fortress in the history of all warfare. I mean, Normandy, you know, was the longest day. Iwo Jima was the longest 36 days. The Japanese were not on Iwo Jima. They were in Iwo Jima. There were 22,000 people underground. It was a 22,000-person mall. They could walk through 16 miles of tunnels. Supplies, they had electricity down there, ventilation systems, multiple exits. So when the American boys hit Iwo Jima, they were walking over the heads of the Japanese.
On that first day, they didn't know yet. They had watched the Navy bombard that island for forever, it seemed, and they must have thought that maybe the defenders had been wiped out.
Iwo Jima is the number one most bombed point of World War II in the Pacific. They dropped more bombs from planes. 72 days they bombed it. Then the Navy came in, and they lobbed shells the size of Volkswagens. They reshaped the contours of Mount Suribachi. And the Japanese were under there filing their nails, just waiting for the killing to begin of Americans. And there are photos. You see 30, 40,000 Americans looking for an enemy, and bullets are coming at them, but there's no human being. There's no Japanese human being. I interviewed veterans who spent 36 days on the island and never saw a live Japanese.
One of the things that I think is so hard to understand when you look at it from 50 years back. It became obvious at some point that the defenders of this island were going to be defeated, that there was only one end to this battle, but they wouldn't surrender. And it's just almost inconceivable to Western eyes that they simply never gave a thought to surrender.
I lived in Japan, and I have to say that the Japanese military corrupted the educational system, took over the country, militarized the whole thing, and they sold it to the youth as samurai values, and it was not honorable samurai values. These poor kids, what they said to them is, it's against the law for you to surrender. You know, if you have both your arms blown off and you can't walk, you've got to do something. You've got to die in battle. So That's what they, that's how much they respected their young soldiers. And if you did survive, or if you were taken prisoner, let's say you got knocked out and you were taken prisoner by the Americans, your name was stricken from the village rolls. Your name was ripped out of the city hall, and you were non-existent. There was no place you could live in Japan. Each side had to exterminate each other. There were no surrenders.
With that as background, let's come back to what you found about your father and his Navy Cross. Can you tell us what he did that day that resulted in his being decorated with the Navy Cross?
First, I would like to say that there were about 80,000 guys on that island doing similar things. I'm very proud of my father, but the valor. Iwo Jima, there's more medals awarded for valor on Iwo Jima than any battle in the history of the United States. That's the most decorated month in American history. And what my father did, he saw a Marine fall wounded 30 yards away, and my dad stood up, like every corpsman did on Iwo Jima, and ran through 30 yards of, well, it was just like rain. The air was just full of bullets and mortars going off, people dying beside him. He ran out, stabilized the kid with plasma. Others said, we'll come and, you know, motioned to come and help him. He said, he motioned, no, stay where you are. He shielded the boy with his body so that the next bullet my father would take in the back. And then he dragged that young kid through 30 yards of pinging bullets and his attention did not falter until the boy was taken off on a stretcher. People who saw it cried.
He never would tell anybody about this, though.
You know, people, it was a riddle to me, and then now that I have studied what he went through, look at it this way. He was holding people's legs, thinking, you know, wondering if he could get it back on. He probably had 200 teenagers die in his arms and heard their last words. So this is not cocktail talk. And if you've seen that, the first thing you want to do is not have those images in your mind. The last thing you want to do is talk about it.
Yeah. He said to you, though, the only thing I can remember that he did say to you about it was that the real heroes of Iwo Jima were the men who died there?
Yeah. My teacher wanted him to speak and called him a hero, and I told him that. And he looked at me. I was 9 years old. He looked at me like he wanted to embed an idea in my mush head for the rest of my life. And he said, I want you to always remember the heroes of Iwo Jima are the guys who did not come back. Now, I disagree after my research with my father. I know a lot of heroes that did.
Let's talk a little bit then about the men who came back. There were three of the men who raised the flag who did return from Iwo Jima.
Yeah, they not only returned, they returned at the invitation, at the order of a guy named Franklin Delano Roosevelt, and they returned to the Oval Office. Roosevelt died just as they were coming back, and Truman welcomed them. But what had happened, the photo appeared on a Sunday, February 25th, in newspapers all across the country. That Monday, newspaper switchboards were jammed for requests for reprints. And something akin to a patriotic Beatlemania happened. People went crazy over the photo, and it was a mania. Newspapers could not print enough copies week after week to keep up with the demand. Women who only would allow pictures of Jesus and FDR on their dining room wall saw it and immediately cut it out and put it in between those two photos. So Roosevelt needed to raise money for the war effort, and he did that through bond tours. They would tour veterans across the country speaking to the populace, asking them to lend money to the government. And they said, the photo, everyone loves the photo, let's get the guys who raised the flag.
Yeah.
So by the time that order went out from the White House, three were alive, Rene Gagnon, Ira Hayes, and my father, John Bradley. And they came back to parades where 200,000 people would stand in the sleeting hail for 3 hours just to get a glimpse of them. When they went to Houston, the police had to blockade the city because too many cars came from all over Texas to see the boys. They closed down the Loop in Chicago. People went wild over these guys.
Now, I know your dad never talked to you about this, but you've talked to a lot of people about that time. And I wonder what they felt. Do you have any idea what this meant to the three of them at that time to be on that tour?
Oh, yeah, I think I do, because they stood up every chance they had and said how they felt. They said, we're not heroes. took everyone on the island to get that flag up, which was absolutely true. It was just a happenstance moment. They were not heroes. And the more they got up and said, we're not heroes, the more the crowds gave them standing ovations.
Yeah.
And they could never get the point across that it was just a photo and they had not done something special.
Your father dealt with that by going back home, marrying his grade school sweetheart, and going about his life as though, I suppose, he hadn't been there.
Well, my dad's favorite phrase was, it's as simple as that. And he always boiled things down to its most simple level. And at the age of 23, being proclaimed an immortal hero by the president, just imagine, you're proclaimed an immortal hero. At a very young age, he sat down and thought, well, I can be a hero and be interviewed the rest of my life, or I can go towards my priorities. And his priorities were happy marriage, a happy family, a successful career, and contributing to the community. And I think he saw those values as more important than being a hero because of an accidental photograph.
That photograph fills the cover of Flags of Our Fathers, the book James Bradley wrote with Ron Powers.